dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Maximum Film. It is episode 222. That's triple two. And we're talking about movies. It's your host, Sophie Whitey, waiting in the booth with me, all my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up and foremost, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Well, you know, Iffy, it's early December, and I know I should be talking about what's good is, you know, the season, and we're finally in the middle of all the Christmas stuff, and, you know, that there's a movie called The Real Housewives of the North Pole coming on Peacock. But I want to take a moment to share a really weird fact I just learned from my husband, which is that some vegans won't eat figs because figs apparently play a role in the wasp reproductive cycle, which means that pretty much every fig has at least one dead wasp in it. Whoa. I didn't know any of this. Now, it's not like it's a you cut it open and there's a wasp sitting there, but I mean, it's infused, shall we say, into the fruit that they are these codependent species, the wasp and the fig. So just the idea that there's a fruit that is secretly meat, I just thought that was really hilarious.
Giuseppe on Great British Bake Off just used so many figs.
Yes.
So many dead wasps in Paul Hollywood right now.
Well, and Prue was like, you could have gone stronger with the fig, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to just Google fig dead wasp. If you type fig D, and then it's like immediately.
I think gums. You're better off Googling that than meaty fruit.
Yeah, I definitely think so.
That's my drag name.
Meaty fruit's a great drag name.
Oh, yeah.
Coming to the stage now. Let's look up meaty fruit.
And next up, we have the queen of the Midwest herself. You know her. You love her. It's Drea Clark. What's good?
My what's good is directly related to someone in this very conversation.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's Casey, you guys. So what's good with me? I do not listen to our show because I have the voice of a gargoyle.
Oh, stop.
So hearing myself talk is just like, oh, death. And yet someone referenced something, so I was like, oh, who said that? And I went back and listened. You guys, Casey's been adding all of these like little sound bites and fun snippets from the stuff we talk about.
Aww.
Or inside jokes. It's real good. So that's a compliment. But the greater compliment for our fair elf prince, Casey the producer, is this week, our good buddy and podcast friend, Atsuko Akatsuka, who has a Twitter for her grandma. Her grandma did a thing where she did Harry Styles filter, and I thought the result looked like Casey. So again, Atsuko's Japanese grandmother
plus
with the Harry Styles filter gave me a lot of Casey O'Brien, and that was good with me.
So we can tell strangers that Casey's like, okay, if Harry Styles were an elderly Japanese woman.
Hey, Iffy, what's good with you?
Well, what's good with me besides Angela getting liposuction and me finding out about it?
Our 90-day fiancé BFF?
I'm an American woman. I can't give up hot water, electricity. I'm spoiled. I can't live like that.
I also went to see the Grand Canyon, and it was beautiful. I went around this time last year. And yeah, if you haven't seen the Grand Canyon and you're close enough to make an easy trip out of it, definitely go. It's extremely beautiful. Like, as corny as it sounds, it really like the pictures don't do it justice. It looks so vast. But I remember I was sitting by the edge and there's that little voice in my head that's like, just jump off. See what happened. Jump off. I didn't, but I did want to, and
spoiler.
I remember. Yeah, yeah. I remember Molly was like, oh, man, I just want to like hang glide. And I was like, oh, that's the healthy version of what was going on in my head.
Yeah, I could fly.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Why is my brain telling me to jump off and see what happens? And your brain is coming up with activities that would work naturally with this. I don't know. But it's still great. Still gorgeous.
I'll back that up. I did a road trip myself to the Grand Canyon like 3 or 4 years ago with my friend Saucy, the Saucy Aussie. And It is so beautiful. It's those things, you know, many people have transcendent moments in nature, but there really is something about the magnitude of the Grand Canyon. I don't care how cool and indoor and urban you are. You stand next to something like that and you're like, oh, I get it. I'm a microscopic dust. Yeah.
I want to go and really measure if everything I don't know about video games will actually fit in of the Grand Canyon. I got all day.
Oh, well, you know, I would make that the whole podcast, but today we're discussing Last Night in Soho. We're going to answer a question on our hotline, and of course, we're going to have the reason for the season, the Christmas Movie Minute, and in strong with our staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment, Ididic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? First up, you know, this is the parents, the mommy and daddy are fighting type thing. As someone who has done many of Funny or Die videos and worked with Funny or Die, but in a recent Vanity Fair interview, filmmaker Adam McKay spoke publicly for the first time about the dissolution of the creative partnership between him and Will Ferrell. The creative duo were responsible for the movies Anchorman, Talladega Nights, Step Brothers, and production company Gary Sanchez. One of the huge breaking points in the relationship was when McKay recast Will Ferrell's role as Lakers owner Jerry Buss in an upcoming LA Lakers HBO show. McKay recast the part with Will Ferrell's best friend, John C. Reilly, without telling Ferrell. After that, they split up their production company and haven't worked together or spoken since. McKay said, quote, "I fucked up on how I handled that," unquote. Is this important? Do you care?
I think these kinds of partnerships are interesting. To me, what I care more about this is the importance of communication on every level. It's unnecessary. And honestly, there's a lot of Hollywood stories that revolve around this kind of thing because people with artist cores are not always great communicators. They tend to talk a lot, but they're not always great communicators. The idea of making a change like this and not telling someone who is one of your creative partners, and that directly is kind of a judgment on the perceived performance they could give, is hurtful. And to not have that be a conversation, and not, like, I've had my own slights. There is absolutely at least one person that I worked very closely with for over a decade, and I no longer speak to and canceled from my phone because of, like, a single interaction. They're like, no, that's so character defining. And I think, but that's something that more people can relate to about Hollywood than almost anything else about Hollywood is that personal interaction and how those slights last.
Bridges light quick, burn fast.
Oh yeah. It really is, like, you know, you have to also understand that we're in an industry of egos. I mean, you know, Alonso often feeling the wrath, being a critic, you know, that is just one, just thrown at him in random movies, or, you know, one Malcolm and Marie, you get one of, you know, when you really get under someone's skin, you get one of those services. But yeah, I think Drea hit the nail on the head where it's like, it's so intricate. We're all in therapy, or should be. And it really is, like, there also is just so much, like, especially when you think of this, because, like, my favorite line is in the additional info. There's a quote that he has where, in my head, I was like, we'll let all this blow over, 6 months to a year. We'll sit down, we'll laugh about it and go, it's all business junk. Who gives a shit? We worked together for 25 years. Are we really going to let this go away? But McKay said, Ferrell took it as a way deeper hurt than I ever imagined. And I tried to reach out to him and I reminded him some slights that were thrown my way that were never apologized for, which is the perfect way to go about any argument. Is to talk about the, like, okay, well
you know.
But I know the more I think about it, it's very interesting too, because I feel like, you know, this is as one comedian speaking on another comedian, like, it always, like, is very, a lot of the comedians I know make a big thing of, like, doing dramatic stuff. Like, it's very important to them because it gives them the opportunity to show another side.
Every clown wants to play Hamlet, as they say.
Exactly. And so I could feel like this is one of those moments, because in current history, when's the last time Will Ferrell has played like a dramatic role?
Yeah, it's been a minute. I mean, he's definitely
along the way, but it's been a while.
And also the idea too of something that you have ownership in. It'd be one thing if he was hired by like some outside production company who was like, we've decided to switch it up. That would hurt anyway, to have it be your partner in your own company.
The
your
other
own
boss
production
has
company.
Fired you. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, no, it is such a judgment call. And really, I agree with Iffy. The part that killed me was, listen, I tried to reach out to him after that. I'm like, oh, good, good. And then I reminded him of the slights. I was like, oh, sweet baby. No. Let's write a list of what you need to talk to somebody about.
You know, look, maybe my thought is that Sid and Marty Krofft are the platonic ideal of a showbiz collaboration. But I always think these things work better when you've got like the creative guy and the money guy. And here you've got creative guy plus creative guy with, I'm sure, lots of money guys in the next office. And yeah, eventually that's just not gonna gel well.
And I will cap that off by saying my door is open to money guys. Just yes. Give me a shout.
Call
I only
Drea.
Have that one person I'm not speaking to. Everyone else I'm a true delight to.
Care of this program.
Exactly. All right. You guys, something else delightful. That's right. Oh, I'm using this line. Sometimes God smiles down on us and gives us manna to sustain us. That is right. According to Channing Tatum's Twitter post, there will be a conclusion to the Magic Mike trilogy called Magic Mike's Last Dance. The previous films in the trilogy, of course, are Magic Mike and Magic Mike XXL, which follows the exploits of male stripper Magic Mike Lane. Like the original film, it will be directed by Steven Soderbergh, and it will release directly on HBO Max. Is this important, my stripping dancing friends? Do you care?
This is the text message I immediately sent to my agent and manager upon Channing Tatum's release of this. And I immediately, for those who can't see, it says, my time is now. Keep an eye out.
Get Effie into that room.
Yes.
Please.
It makes me so uncomfortable when you get sexy, Iffy, but I could not support that more. And again, if there's calls I can make, I will start a petition.org to get Iffy
on top of the headshot.
Send
the picture
dance.
I took for
I was just gonna say, send Soderbergh the picture of Iffy with my book, and that way we all win.
Yeah. Soderbergh's like, while I'm at it, can you order that book for me? I gotta see what this is about.
Yeah.
And who's the dude with the booming system?
Nice. Listen, I love the Magic Mike films, and I also love Channing Tatum. I have to say, Video Gum, which I brought up recently when Andrew T was our guest, had they referred to Channing Tatum as Charming Potato. So I always see him that way, and I will always love that. And I am a huge fan of the Charming Potato. And it's decade later, and it's still so just twee and wonderful to me that he paired with Steven Soderbergh to make movies about his time as a male stripper. Like, good for you, my guy. And that they're such fun rides. And I don't know. I'm a big fan of these. Really enjoy them. Can't wait to see what they do with these. The next one, because I do think they take insightful and interesting sort of routes in the male psyche. And they're fun little romps. And they also have all those hot dudes in them.
I have to say, I don't love these movies.
Really?
I admire the first one for being a bait and switch, where it was like they were selling it like, yes, come see all the balls and G-strings. And then it was a movie about like economic, you know, anxiety, basically. And I was like, okay, well, I admire the grift on that, but I didn't think the movie was even all that interesting on the economic anxiety level, much less the dancing. And then the second one, I was like, okay, this is a fun kind of dopey road trip with dopey people. But there was so much excitement on Twitter when this announcement went out that like, we're getting a third Magic Mike, and everybody's just losing their minds of like, okay. Okay, this is just not a fandom I'm in. I'm sorry.
I think it's a smart move for HBO Max too, I will say, because it's not going to be theatrical. It'll be a digital release on a platform that is trying to come up with original content to lure in new subscribers. And to me, this seems right in the sweet spot. This seems the kind of film that people all over could do, like, all right, we're doing a girls and gays night and come on over and we're going to watch the new Magic Mike and shriek into our Chardonnay in my living room.
Well, that, I mean, the Soderbergh movie with Meryl Streep on the cruise liner, that was an HBO Max original, right? So, yeah.
Did that movie really happen? Or did we just see it?
Did we dream it during the pandemic?
A collective dream. Know. Yeah. I liked that movie.
Candace Bergen wore denim fringe. I'm pretty sure
she truly did.
Speaking of the fringe, there's a lot of chatter about the movie House of Gucci this week. And who could blame them? Fashion designer Tom Ford criticized the film, saying, quote, "I was not completely sure that I wasn't watching a Saturday Night Live version of the tale," unquote. He also added, "It was hard for me to see the humor and camp in something that was so bloody. In real life, none of it was camp. It was at times absurd, but ultimately it was tragic," unquote. The real Gucci family has also been vocal in their disdain for the movie. They put out a statement this week denouncing the film. This comes after Patrizia Gucci criticized the casting of Al Pacino as Aldo Gucci, saying, "My grandfather was a very handsome man, like all the Guccis, and very tall, blue eyes, and very elegant. He is being played by Al Pacino, who is not very tall already, and this photo shows him as fat, short, with sideburns, really ugly, shameful, because he doesn't resemble him at all," unquote. In response to the casting of Al Pacino as Aldo Gucci, director Ridley Scott said, "How could they be better represented than by Al Pacino? Excuse me, you probably have the best actors in the world. You should be so fucking lucky." Unquote. Is this important? Do you care?
I'm going to tell you now, if somebody cast Al Pacino as me, I'd probably be having more of a Patrizia Gucci reaction than a Ridley Scott one. I'd be like, my favorite thing, can we go back? Her quote, "My grandfather was a very handsome man, like all the Guccis." That's how you do it. That's how you do a press quote. Let me just get my entire lineage complimented in like 12 words or less.
Well, as we know, the European fashion community is all filled with humor and they don't take themselves seriously.
Yes.
And, you know, they definitely are you know open who else? To
good sports. Yes.
You know who else? Good sports. Super funny. The very rich.
Yeah. Well, here he comes. Here's where Patrizia Gucci can, take whatever she said and shove it up her ass. Anytime your description of beauty includes blue eyes, I can tell you, go fuck yourself completely. and take that shit right back to the Hitler Youth camp that it started in, because that's the shit you're peddling right now.
All I can think is, if I'm an actual Gucci, like, of all the things in the movie House of Gucci to which I would object and how the family they portrayed, the casting of Al Pacino is low on the list.
Yeah. I will say Tom Ford's reaction itself was very measured, and he is in a super unique scenario in that he is a well-established, highly credible fashion designer himself. He's also a celebrated filmmaker, and he actually knew these people in real life. Like,
he's portrayed in the film.
Yeah, exactly. By Reeve Carney.
By the guy from Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Spider-Man on set. Or the one where Spider-Man kept like breaking the entire theater. Yeah.
Yeah. And as several people on the Facebook page pointed out, the idea that the director of Nocturnal Animals is criticizing a movie about tone, that for what it's worth. I like Nocturnal Animals, but I hear what you're saying.
And I do. I felt when I read it, his point of view, he was acknowledging, like, listen, I'm in a unique scenario here. My perspective on this is weird. Of course, I'm going to feel in a more specific way than other people because of how I'm tied to this. But also, I think it's too camp and too bummer. And, you know, I mean, it was kind of a bummer in real life. We watch we make a lot of entertainment about stuff that are real bummer uncles.
I know I think that's what's kind of funny about it is like, and it's kind of like what I like to call, God rest his soul, the Chef Effect, which like Chef from South Park, Isaac Hayes, who had no problems, you know, with any of the stuff it was lampooning. And then when it came to him, he's like, oh, fuck this.
Too far.
He's like, it's like you. So you watch all of cinema and you're like, oh, it's cool. Any of these portrayals, fine. But I knew these people. This is like, no, bro, that's you. You know this. You do this. So you know it. You know, I wish I wish directors were even more petty. Like Ridley Scott was like, man, when I see you at the Academy, it's hands, it's on site. Tom Ford, don't walk in L.A. or I'm throwing hands.
I'm sure this is going to be like that. You see these pieces online every so often of like director on director shade, and this just gets added to the list now.
It's because actors have egos, writers, like in the ego totem pole, I feel like it starts the writer, then you got your actors, and then you got the directors up here. So like, you know, Ridley's
also 1,000 years old popping. And has like the receipts. He's fine just wearing Hugo Boss for the rest of his days. Like, he does not care.
Yeah. The group chat is popping. And I want to see what they want to see, like him and Scorsese, like, can you believe this? Yeah, that's a Casey, take that game. Who's in whose group chat in directors? I'm like that. All right, we're gonna take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Last Night in Soho.
Okay, we are here to talk about microdosing. If you don't know about it, you can look it up, no problem. I'm just learning myself. Good news, microdose gummies have microdoses of THC, and they just released 6 flavors of higher THC gummies based on sativa, indica, and hybrid strains. And guess what? Because it's hemp-derived THC, they're available nationwide. You can check them out and other information about microdosing at microdosegummies.com.
So I took one, and it was really interesting because I know people who talk about how that is part of their work day, you know, that the weed keeps them focused and you know, they really operate from the THC and they get so much done. And that did not scan with anything I ever knew about THC and what it does. But it turns out, yes, there's all kinds of different ones, and they hit you in different ways. So I tried one, and I was just, you know, watching a Hallmark movie. And next thing I knew, I was also creating a list in Letterboxd of all the Hallmark movies I'd seen that year. And I thought, oh, wow, I'm feeling so organized all of a sudden. I get what this is about now. Because it just really, I was feeling really chill, but it also like really kind of clarified me. And I felt like I need to accomplish things. So that was kind of groovy. And then, of course, I got really hungry. And then I had a lovely sleep that night. So really a full, complete experience with these.
There's a reason that microdosing is becoming so popular for health and wellness. And if you want to learn more about microdosing THC, just do quick research online. Do your own research. Or go to microdosegummies.com and get them delivered to your door. To get free shipping and 30% off your first order, use code MAXFILM. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdosegummies.com and code MAXFILM, MAXFILM.
Hello, I'm Pee Wee Herman. You might know me from TV, but I really want to be a DJ. It took some convincing, but KCRW finally agreed to give me an hour on the radio to play you some music with my friends. Anyway, tune in for 1 hour of the bestest, most funnest time you'll ever have on the Pee Wee Herman Radio Hour. I am personally inviting you to tune your transistor radio in to hear me, or go to kcrw.com. Duh. It'll be available for the whole week from November 26th to December 3rd, so you can listen to it again and again and again and again and again.
The Pee Wee Herman Radio Hour was produced by Maximum Fun and can be streamed on kcrw.com until December 3rd.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duralde.
And today, we're talking about Last Night in Soho. Drea, would you mind providing us with a brief synopsis?
All right. So we follow Eloise, a young college student who is about to study fashion design in the big city of London, coming from the small ville of Cornwall. She has been very homeschooled and protected and is a naive, innocent young woman who also appears to have some sort of history of mental illness and has recently lost her mother, though she keeps seeing specters of her mother. She gets to London and fashion design school kind of clashes with the other students and decides to rent out a bedsit rather than live in the dorms. So she moves in upstairs from the genial old woman who rents her the place and very quickly discovers that at night, instead of going to sleep, she finds herself in 1960s Soho, London, the swinging 60s. She's following a young, beautiful woman her own age named Sandy, who wants to be a star. She's a singer and a dancer who takes up with a possibly nefarious young man played by Matt Smith. And so she's sort of crossing over, and then sometimes the crossing over starts to happen in the day, and sometimes the crossing over comes the other way, and it becomes a very puzzling mixture of how she and Sandy's lives are intertwined and how dramatic and terrifying it's going to become, all while being impeccably styled. And I can't see watching this film and not wanting to cut bangs. That's my main takeaway. Yeah.
Drea, why do you hate women? You skipped all of the actresses, but you named Matt Smith.
Oh, it's not that I hate women. It's that I love Doctor Who. And he was the 11th Doctor, and I adore him forever. I really did, didn't I? Yes. Anya Taylor-Joy plays Sandy, and our main woman is played by Thomasin McKenzie, who we all loved so much in Leave No Trace.
Yes. And Diana Rigg plays the...
Diana Rigg's the landlady. Final performance.
And also Eloise's grandmother is played by British film icon Rita Tushingham. So between Rita Tushingham and Diana Rigg and then a mysterious character lurking about played by Terrence Stamp, there's a lot of genuine, like, British 60s, you know, mod explosion going on in this movie.
Lots of proper British 60s stars. And this film definitely takes a turn from being like boop, 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 bop, bop to rah, rah, rah.
Yeah, it wasn't all like, you know, Sandy Shaw and Kinks records. It was, you know.
I think for me, what stood out, I'll say I'm kind of glad we don't have a guest, just our safe little nest, because it's been a while that I had such a conflicting reaction to a film. Mm-hmm. I think that it is assuredly made and beautiful. I mean, there are so many components of this where it's like, Edgar Wright is so good at like pulling people together. And like Alonzo says, his references are deep. Like he not just knows film, he loves films. He loves film history and it comes across and the tone and the set, the costumes, needle drops. I mean, shut up with the music. It's so tonal and wonderful. And I also, what I want to applaud him for, even though it's one of the things I have the biggest hiccups with, is he's faced a lot of valid criticism over the years of not really engaging a lot of female characters, not having characters of color in significant roles. And I think that for him, I'm completely projecting and 100% guessing, but you know, he made this after Baby Driver. Easily could have made 12 more Baby Drivers. I'm sure everyone involved would have been happy with that. And instead, to do something that's it's his least accessible film. It's the least sort of bubblegum deliciousness of film. And he's really trying something. And I think it's noteworthy that it's the only film that really pivots around female characters. Scott Pilgrim, you have a strong female character in Ramona Flowers, but she's also a manic pixie dream girl of a sort. You know what I mean?
Like that's,
and that's, yeah, and that's from source material outside of him. Fair enough. But this is the first time that he had this concerted effort. I'm going to make a film around these women, and I want to have a sympathetic view to how women go through the world. And he did this with a co-writer, Christy Wilson Cairns, who also co-wrote 1917, a film shockingly similar, or equally British anyway. But
that steeped in femininity, that 1917.
Everyone knows that. Female film of the year. But in Last Night in Soho, there is this effort to show women and to show the small and big ways in which they face struggles constantly. I say they as if I'm not a woman. We, damn it, we. But, you know, you see Eloise sort of like have this immediately creepy cab driver. And you're just like, it's earned. Her wariness of the world is earned. And then it, of course, exacerbates in Sandy's story, which is like, oh, her boyfriend's actually a mean pimp. And oh, she's not a singer, but they're making her like become a sex worker. And it becomes so grand. It loses authenticity. But that's my question for you guys. Do you think this film is interested in authenticity? Like, or is it of just a theatrical endeavor?
I mean, you know, I think obviously, you know, he didn't pick, you know, this movie isn't set during the Blitz, you know, like he wanted it to be set in Soho in the 60s and now in Soho as well. But very much even in the present, like there's a lot of talk, especially because Eloise, you know, having grown up with her grandmother, like loves 60s fashion, loves 60s music, like is totally, you know, mired in that stuff. So he's clearly interested in that, and it is a very glamorous period to make a movie about and to sort of create this kind of fantasia. I was almost reminded of, and it's not nearly as good a movie, but what Julian Temple is trying to do with the 50s in Absolute Beginners, in sort of recreating these sort of packed London streets where like art and music and all these things are exploding around you and the young people are having this kind of, you know, cultural revolution. And so, you know, you have Sandy, who we're introduced to, is this, you know, she's very forthright and she steps right up to the manager of the club and tells, you know, says what she wants and immediately, you know, like falls into his arms. And then she does an audition and she nails it and she sings the song really well. But then before she knows it, she's like a stripper and a sex worker, none of it at her behest, you know. And then I'm just going to fuck it. I'm going to jump to the ending and spoil the ending. And if it's been out for a while, if you haven't seen it, maybe jump ahead or I'll. We find out that in the visions that that Eloise has of Sandy, she thinks that Sandy is eventually being murdered. But she comes to realize that, no, actually, Sandy is a murderer. Sandy murdered all of these dudes who were trying to fuck her. And who knows where the corpses are, but the ghosts are still rattling around that bedsit. And lo and behold, Diana Rigg, ta-ta-ta-ta, is Sandy and tries to murder Eloise and her boyfriend so that to keep her tracks covered. And that, to me, is where the movie turns, because I think you have a real sympathy for, like you said, the cab driver, the awful schoolmates. Like, you know, we're rooting for these characters, for Eloise and for Sandy. But then to make Sandy a murderer who wants to kill Eloise seems to throw all of that stuff out the window and just makes her into another monster in this movie, you know. And yes, fine, it would be too simplistic to have it be like, oh, the men are terrible and the women are looking out for each other. But in this context, to have Sandy wind up being the person who's trying to kill Eloise, I feel like it then makes you want to ask Edgar Wright, so what is this even about then? Like, what is the point of this? What are you trying to say with this? Because it seems like there's a point of view and then there isn't a point of view. And if there is a point of view, it's maybe kind of like, I don't know if it's misogynist, but it's at least ill thought out.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Because like, I often think, would it have been more interesting if, you know, and this would be just a lot of suffering to probably get to this, but if the boyfriend wasn't necessarily a good guy and she was kind of stuck in this shitty relationship, and you kind of see
Eloise's boyfriend Sandy's.
Yeah, Eloise's. Oh, okay. And then like you kind of see this as her helping her get out. But I definitely see what you mean, where it is like, by like, you by making her like, I mean, like, I'm going to kill you now. Like, it removes all the kind of things that we were building to and almost the momentum. And I'm totally fine watching a movie where all men are bad, you know, but it is funny. Cause it's one of those things, right? Where like we often talk about this, on this show specifically, of when you have, you know, solely a woman writing about these experiences versus a man there, when you're a man, there tends to be like some sympathy. Like you got to be like, well, not you, there's a little, not all men. We like to add into our scripts. We can't exist in this world because we don't. We think of ourselves, and if we make a movie that all men are bad, am I saying that I too am bad? No, we have to have a good guy boyfriend, you know?
I guess I'd add another layer to that, mm-hmm. back to my earliest premise of like Edgar trying to reach out beyond the kind of white cisgender thing. Mm-hmm. Her sweethearted gentle boyfriend is played by a black actor, and part of me I was like, oh, how nice. There are mm-hmm. sweethearted, gentle yeah. men out
you're,
there.
You're talking to and one of them.
Yeah, I'm talking to one of them right now. Thank you, Alonso. So like, so I appreciated that. However, it felt like there was so much effort put in to make this sweethearted black boyfriend nothing but kind and good. And we have a scene with them that made me so uncomfortable because of its framing, where Eloise, you know, as we mentioned, she sees ghosts and she sees, just specters in general. And she has one of these fits while she's hooking up with this young man and starts screaming and freaking out. And he can tell it's not about him, but he doesn't know what to do. They're in bed and she is screaming and terrified. And, you know, the landlady comes in and is like, I'm going to call the cops. And he, the whole time, and when he sees her again, is so nothing but warm and forgiving. And yet she put him in such specific danger in that situation because he's a black character. And I don't know if that was taken into consideration. Maybe it was. No, again, make this movie.
It 100% wasn't. But once it roots back to that issue. And to be honest, like, once again, like, in no way can I ever blame Edgar Wright growing up, you know, white, to even know, like, you, that's something you wouldn't even really think about unless you really think about it. And you're right.
And he was just trying to make a nice guy, you know?
I was straight up, you would not see me again. It would be a long convo before you saw me again if I was put in that situation, even if I knew it wasn't your fault. Because now I have to protect myself and make sure that I'm not put in that situation again.
And I'll tell you, you know what, that is such a Hallmark thing where it's like, oh, we'll make the sympathetic coworker Asian, or we'll make the mayor black.
Yeah.
And it's like, it. Yes, on the one hand, you are diversifying your cast and stuff, but you're also not giving these characters to play. You're just giving opportunities to actors of color, but you're not giving them characters that are nearly as three-dimensional as your white leading lady.
Yeah. And it can, not to get like too representational, but that's exactly what leads to the concept of tokenism in real life of, this person shouldn't have been shot because they were a straight A student. Like, well, they just shouldn't have been shot.
Yeah. How about we start there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Separate from all of this, I'd love to talk. One of the very fun things, as much as this movie sort of, the first two thirds of it, I was like, ooh, this is cracking along. It's so visually interesting. And what am I? And the last third, you're like, We've turned. But throughout, this is a movie chock-a-block full of so many cinematic tricks. There's so much beautiful stuff done with like stunt doubles and mirrors, and do you know what I mean? Like all of these fun things. If that alone almost would make me recommend it. If you are someone, I could rewatch it on mute just to try and figure out. Like, there's a whole dance sequence where Sandy and Eloise keep switching out, like it's in one of the sort of dream scenarios, and they just, but it looks like so fluid, and the idea of what the mirrors represent and all of the ways that it's shot to kind of give you this idea of you know, the beyond coming through.
Yeah, no, it's gorgeous. And this is exactly like, you know, we talk about how boring CG is when you, well, you can just do anything and it can just be anything and it'll be amorphous and have no gravity and no thing if you're giving me like monsters or a giant spaceship or whatever. But if you use CG to, like, you know, erase the cars from modern San Francisco to make it look like the Zodiac Killer, or if you are, you know, putting Thomas and McKenzie in these rows of mirrors that you know Anya Taylor-Joy is walking in front of, that doesn't scream out necessarily as special effect, but it conveys all this stuff and it takes you into a headspace of these characters in a way that you could not do in a practical way.
One of Casey's questions, which I think is fair, except for now I feel badly. In the, because we, as you, as maybe if you listen, you know this, but if you didn't, we discussed the, didn't we discuss all of Edgar's, the trilogy?
We did the Cornetto trilogy, yes. Mm-hmm.
So we discussed Shaun of the Dead,
Hot Fuzz,
and The World's End. And then obviously he has films in addition to that, some of which we've referenced. But, you know, we've talked about him in good detail. How do you think this looks for you in terms of his progression as a filmmaker, even with these bumps? Like, do you think this was a miss swing or just an interesting swing or what?
Well, I'll tell you, I hated Baby Driver. Hated Baby Driver. So this was definitely a step up from there.
Would you have hated it as much if it was the same movie, but someone else was the lead and not Ansel Elgort?
That didn't help, but I think there were other issues I had with the film.
Shout out to him, who is currently on a press tour that everyone is reminding people that he's not great.
There's a lot to unpack there. But no, I appreciate the ambition, and I think that with Wright's movies, even the ones that don't quite work or don't quite immediately find an audience, like, they become cult items. And I could see this movie having a cult for people who like the sort of the time elements to it, and you know, the two lead actresses who are, you know, at the beginnings, both of them, of really what are going to be extraordinary careers, I think. It's not entirely a hit, but I think he's at least trying to do something new and certainly showing off more things in his bag of tricks, which is an extensive one. And, you know, I jokingly said to Dave, oh, this is his only horror movie except for, you know, the Don't trailer from Grindhouse, you know, which I would love to see that made into a movie. But in the meantime, you know, this works.
I like that you count this over Shaun of the Dead, which is fair enough because Shaun of the Dead is not.
I never think of Shaun of the Dead as a horror movie, but you're right. Same. I guess it is.
Yeah,
it's sort of chock full of zombies.
Love it. Okay. But, you know, Casey also asked, how does this rank among the swinging 60s movies? And the one that I would recommend, it's not streaming anywhere, but you can get it on Blu-ray, and you should, is a comedy called Smashing Time, starring Rita Tushingham, who plays the grandmother in this movie, and Lynn Redgrave. And it's about two, much like the Thomas and McKenzie character, it's about two girls from the North who go down to London in the 60s and have a smashing time. And it was made in swinging London of the 60s during the swinging London of the 60s. So there's a lot of just, you know, they just turned the camera on and there it was.
Yeah. Hey guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Should we vote?
Oh, I
guess. Yeah, I was too busy trying to Google swinging 60s London movies to see if I had anything to contribute. And it seems like the answer is no. Let's just go.
Austin Powers it is.
Austin Powers!
I'm so mad because, yep, you're right. That's the only one. So for our final review of Last Night in Soho, would you screen it, stream it, or skip it?
I'll start. I would say stream it because there's interesting stuff going on here. There are some cool ideas. There are some fun performances. And again, yeah, this movie is just dripping with style. And I imagine, yes, a lot of that would probably translate better to the big screen. But you can pause and rewind and just like drink all of that in, even if there are other issues you might have with the writing.
Ooh, okay, Drea, what do you think?
Yeah, I would also be a stream it. I really enjoyed watching this. Like, as much as it started to get puzzling because I was trying to figure out the mechanics and who are the ghosts and is she time traveling and what am I? It was still so delicious to see, and I loved how stylized it was, and I loved all the references and all of the follow-up things. Like, just go watch videos of him talking about inspiration pieces or anything. And I think there's a lot you could learn from this film, even if you would fix this film in certain ways yourself. But yeah, a hearty stream it.
Yeah. I'm a screen it. I'm a dork for, Edgar Wright. I did like Baby Driver. I think on our episode, we went through this.
Probably.
So I was rocking with it, and I love his vision. He definitely brings something fun and interesting that I always enjoy to ingest. So, I was forced to watch this on, albeit big 72-inch screen, but I'd love to see it.
Oh, yeah, I heard about your old TV.
Don't worry, sure. Because this Christmas, I'm definitely going to upgrade to an 80-inch. So what? You're going to be hearing about, I need to go. You know it. But, we'll get into more fun stuff after we're back, because we're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back right after that.
Hey there, beautiful people. Did you hear that good, good news?
Something about the baby Jesus?
He's coming back!
Or do you mean the fact that Apple Podcasts has named Fanti one of the best shows of 2020?
I mean, we already knew that we was hot stuff, but a little external validation never hurts, okay?
Hosted by me, writer and journalist Jared Hill.
And me, the ebony enchantress myself, Javel Anderson.
Fanti is your home for complex conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the people, places, and things we're huge fans of, but got some anti-feelings toward.
You name it, we Fanti. Nobody's off limits.
Check us out every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your slayworthy audio.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Sophie Whiteway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Drea Clark.
And we're going to answer a question from our hotline. This one's an email question from Abby from Wisconsin. Shout out to Cheese.
Wisconsin!
Yeah. Pringle. The Midwestern hero. Bow to your queen, Drea. I'm just going to imagine you've done the bowing. One of my very favorite films is Tony Erdmann, which has so many deliciously awkward moments that in another movie would be played solely for laughs. In this film, however, these moments play out and out and out until the characters and the audience have no choice but to ride along till the scene reaches emotional catharsis. What are some films that test you as an audience member but lead to a more meaningful experience as a result? Oh, man, this can mean
that's
so many things.
That's such a good question.
Yeah, that's a solid question, and I have
and
so
it's
many
such a good
different
That movie
answers.
Is a great example, too, because it's really unique in that it's trying to make you uncomfortable in so many ways because there's a performance art element to a lot of it. Yeah. I immediately what I thought of the first film, I thought of a couple, but not to brag, I thought of a couple, but Dogtooth by Yorgos Lanthimos. If you haven't seen it, Iffy or anyone else, it's a trip, and I love his movies and I love him as a filmmaker.
Yeah, this is kind of his brand, I think. Discomfort.
You know what, truthfully, yes, that is fair. You could say pretty much any of
Yorgos
Lanthimos' films.
Favorites.
The sacred killing of sacred deer.
Yeah.
But Dogtooth, it's his first film, and it's, I believe, it's his first film.
Second, I want to say.
Second film. Okay. And it is about this family. Two parents and then these grown sort of teenage children, and they all live on a compound, and the parents have explained to the children they're never allowed to leave. They've never seen the real world. They only know each other. They only know this farcical lie that their parents have taught them. So they have like no skills, and the father brings in like this prostitute for the son. It just has all this weird sexual flowers in the attic stuff because these kids don't know any better. And it's also all from the parents controlling them in all these ways. It is so well made and so able to do all this. So it's all this stuff I admire about independent film and like innovative vision. And yet there's so many scenes that I'm like, oh my God, is she still licking her sister's shoulder? Is the shoulder licking? Is it still, or is someone going to tell me? And that, yeah, I think that's that kind of feeling I'm thinking of. I don't know if I get emotional catharsis from Dogtooth, but I get a lot of sort of intellectual stimulation.
I like a movie that makes you meet it on its level. You know, there's a film from Vietnamese filmmaker named Tran Anh Hung called The Scent of Green Papaya. And it is one of those movies where there's just like long stretches of people preparing food or like ironing a suit or something. And you just have to kind of like, I don't know if it's an East-West kind of thing or something, or just the kind of movies that maybe you're used to, but you have to sort of take a deep breath and be like, I'm just going to go with this. I'm going to go with this, and I'm going to trust that the movie is going to take me somewhere interesting. And in that case, it certainly does. And I think there were a couple of films that we did on a film and a movie, weirdly enough, that fit the bill, one of which, when Drea came on, we talked about the Jean Dielman, which is a film that really takes its time to let you know where it's going and really forces you to understand the drab, like soul-draining minutiae of a housewife's day-to-day existence and making the potato soup and shining the shoes and all the stuff that like would normally be covered in a montage or like really you'd get a couple seconds of it. Oh, no. You're going to, Chantal Ackerman is going to take you through every second of the potato peeling process so that you know what this woman's day-in, day-out drudgery is like. And it drives some people nuts, but if you go with the rhythm, it totally pays off.
Ooh. I was gonna talk about, you know, I feel like another element of like the test and what I feel like feels great, because sometimes I feel like a movie will just generally will get a reaction out of everyone, and the discussions that come from it, I think, are the meaningful part. You know, a movie that I think I've brought up many times on this pod, but it's probably, I think it's one of my favorites because I'm one of the few people who I'm like, I fucked with it. And everyone's like, I didn't. But you know, my man, Aronofsky's Mother, with an exclamation point. I found that, like, because I think I watched it like two or three times, but I think I had the most fun just talking about it and discussing it with people. And I think that is something that I feel like we both, because I don't feel like we lost it. I feel like it went the other way in the pendulum, where I like the nature of online, like we have this forum where we can discuss things, but everyone's so obsessed with being right about it that instead of just like openly having their own idea of what they took from cinema. Like everyone's like, well, what is the right thing? What, oh, you think that? No, that's not what it was. And it's like, no, it was. Because that's what I got. So it was the right thing. What you got, that's great. And I'm happy for you.
Because art is all about definitive answers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an objective medium.
Yeah.
I want to give a shout, because I'd regret this later, but I do want to give an honorable mention to 2017's The Square. So maybe Abby in Wisconsin, if you haven't seen it and you are a Tony Erdmann fan, The Square might be right up your alley. It's a Swedish film and it's about an art gallery, and the curator hires this PR company to sort of like up its, but it involves like, there is a scene where there's a performance artist at this like black tie dinner and it goes on for so long. And you are as confused as the patrons and as nervous and as like, oh, what's this guy going to do? What's this guy going to do? So I think actually that one might hit that same tone.
And Force Majeure from the same director, I think.
Same director. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, also puts so you good. Through the mill. The other one I want to shout out real quick, which was, we also did on Film and a Movie, is Celine and Julie Go Boating, which is a movie that
love that movie.
I love that movie so much. It's one of my very favorites. But literally, every time I watch it, I spend the first half thinking, what is even going on here? Where is any of this going? What is the point of this? And then the second half, you're just completely riveted because you click into its weird dream logic and you understand why it's important that they have the candy in the mouth, but not the other half of the candy, and who has the child, and do they remember the dialogue as the nurse? And, you know, it's nuts in the best way. And I think just it's the kind of thing where you just want to, like, hand the director a beer when it's over. It's like, yeah, I managed that tightrope walk.
I guess we'll keep chugging along. Thank you so much, Abby. It was great answering your question. This was a great question. Very. Good question.
Cheers. Well,
you know, look, looks like the hotline well is dry again, and we need calls, we need emails, because right now we have a dry ass hotline.
Oh,
we
want to
turn it into a wet ass hotline. So we need y'all to come calling in and emailing. The number is 979-803-1664. The email is maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. You know the drill. If you want to hear me stop saying that, you gotta send it.
There's
in.
Some calls in this house.
Yeah. There's some calls in this house. There's some calls.
Alonzo made that joke.
Oh, it's so great.
It is the season for miracles.
Oh, speaking of the season, thank you for that. That was an alley-oop. I grabbed it. Yes. Windmill dunk it. It's that time again where we leave out a tray of Christmas cookies, a glass of milk, and a bag of dots for the Christmas Zaddy, Alonzo Duralde. It's the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. As we all know, Alonzo gets 1 minute to discuss every Christmas movie he saw this past week. Alonzo, are you ready?
I am ready.
Then get ready to start as soon as the music drops.
Okay, so I had a lot of deadlines this week, so I really just saw 4 movies, so I don't have to rush quite so much. But anyway, I watched 8-Bit Christmas on HBO Max. It's this sort of weird hybrid of, like, A Christmas Story and The Princess Bride, but mostly works and is pretty charming. It's about a kid who's desperate to get his hands on a Nintendo for Christmas in, like, 1987. I liked it a lot. Twas the Fight Before Christmas is this bonkers documentary on Apple TV Plus about a guy whose Christmas decorations were so obnoxious that he had to go to court and is now barred from putting them up. But it's a whole much more complicated story than that, and by the end of it, you're not even sure who you're rooting for anymore. Meanwhile, over at Hallmark, The Nine Kittens of Christmas, long-awaited sequel to Nine Lives of Christmas, was okay. The kittens were a little too old, but An Unexpected Christmas, surprisingly delightful, really well written by Paul Campbell, who's usually a Hallmark actor. Tyler Hines and Bethany Joy Lenz really nail it. Smart and funny lesbian sister. Really enjoyed it. That's the one to check out so far this year of the new Hallmark movies.
I saw you tweet about that one because the lead on it played a super hot tattooed skater scumbag on Letterkenny.
Yes, Long Dick Dirks.
Every time he pops up on a Hallmark, I'm like, what? You should take your shirt off and skateboard again.
Yeah, Dave.
Why
finds
you got
it,
this Hallmark hair?
Dave finds it disconcerting when he's in Hallmark mode too.
Yeah. Good for him. Crash
yeah.
the checks.
He, yeah, like, and look, it's called acting, Drea.
Oh, acting!
What do you so does this mean that your next one is going to be doubled up because you only watched 4?
Next week's going to be crazy. Once I start having enough time to really catch up, it's going to be blah, 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 blah. So
yeah. Wow.
Get ready, right, everybody.
I am. Well, now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. So Drea, why don't you start?
Oh, I will, Iffy. Thank you, young man. Thank you. Hey, you boy, is it still, what day is it? I'm trying to do Scrooge. I didn't even get the line right. I also have problems that
as
I just called Iffy
Cloris
boy.
Leachman,
I don't feel good
don't
about
know.
That. Cloris Leachman, I'd be so proud. I have a very good staff pick, if I do say so myself. It is an animated documentary coming out this weekend called Flea. It premiered at a festival called Sundance last year. I know. It's a Danish documentary by Jonas Perher Rasmussen. And it's an unusual documentary in that it's animated, which doesn't often happen. And one of those reasons is that the man who's telling the story, it's about his life. It's largely about him fleeing Afghanistan for safety and for love. And he's now in Denmark and married to a man named Jasper, and reflecting back on what he's lost and how his life is, and has all of these rich stories of all he's lived through. And one of the big elements of it is he hasn't spoken about any of these things to anyone, including his husband. And it's so beautifully illustrated and made, and it gives insight. You know, a lot of documentaries, you either get a lot of talking head or a lot of archival footage. This is not relying on the same thing. It does have animated talking head of him, but it's emotional and open and moving and such a unique view into someone's very personal, specific life. Flea.
Very excited about seeing that one. I've been hearing great things about it all year. Well, you know, it's funny, Dre, I almost thought that you were stealing my staff pick when you started off quoting A Christmas Carol, because over on the Criterion Channel, they're showing one of my favorite screen adaptations of A Christmas Carol, namely 1970s Scrooge starring Albert Finney in the title role. He is one of the few people to play young Scrooge and old Scrooge in the same movie, which I think really lends this one a lot of just sort of emotional weight. Plus, it's a musical, and it's a musical with songs by the great Leslie Bricus, who passed away not long ago. He and Anthony Newley, of course, co-wrote all the songs for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and a lot of the 60s standards that Sammy Davis Jr. covered. But this is just it's very much a post-Oliver musical. You know, the streets are filled with dancing cockneys, but I've seen so many A Christmas Carol adaptations, and this one gives you a London that feels lived in and not just like two blocks. And the final sequence where a reformed Scrooge goes through London to buy presents and a turkey for the Cratchits, and they reprise like every song in the movie, is just such an explosion of joy. It's one of my favorite things in a movie ever. So I always feel like I've chosen well when a movie that I like gets curated on the Criterion Channel. So yeah, check out Scrooge.
Keeping it going, I'm gonna suggest another movie that Anya Taylor-Joy was in to spice it up, give you something. If you were loving her in this, something you might be loving her in too. Watch a banger. I'm sure Alonzo will definitely back me on this pick right here. Make sure you're watching Split. You're gonna see James McAvoy getting in, doing a lot of weird things with his body. It's gonna be a wild ride. You're gonna see Anya doing what she does best, but James McAvoy doing weird things with that body. So make sure if you enjoyed Last Night in Soho, run, don't walk, to go digest some Split.
Doing weird things with that body.
Dude, watch that movie and tell me if that ain't the best description.
I had a flicker of hope that if he was going to say Emma, but then of course, no, what am I thinking? Of course he's going to go for Split.
Emma's so good. Thoroughbreds is good. But, the witch is good. She's got good stuff.
Yeah. Anyway. And so is Split.
Split.
If you have a suggestion or a comment about this week's show, tweet at us, Maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm, or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned,
audience supported.